Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 123 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this penultimate episode of this season is my good friend Jason, a.k.a. Agent Palmer of Agent Palmer. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Palmer, however you want to be referred to.
I answer to a lot of worse things, so anything will do.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I understand. I've known you long enough, and I've called you some of those names, too.
So, that's true.
You know, when I drove within 10 miles of your house and you didn't want me to come and say hello.
It's literally going to come up every time we record.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But you explained and it's fine. And, you know, we're still on good terms because, you know, you're back and I've invited you back.
Yes.
So it means that everything is fine. You know, okay. I just like to you know, throw out the jabs.
It's fine. You know, it's fine. I can if I couldn't take a punch, I wouldn't be behind the mic.
There you go. Exactly. And you know that it's just friendly punches. It's not even, we're doing movie punches where you don't really get hit. You get to like move your head back a little bit.
That's
before there's any it's a no contact punching.
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. It sounds like fun to me. So minute 123 begins with a list of engineers. And ends with the MPAA symbol adjacent to the AFL-CIO symbol. You know, I know you always get, you know, the credits, so you have to, you know, make it through all of these crazy things that, you know, they put in at the end of every movie. I'm not talking about the credits. I'm talking about the different stamps at the end.
No, like I get that. And I just want to say,
I wasn't belittling the people in the credits.
I feel like I've said this before, but like, I'm also the guy even before like podcasting and Marvel's end credits thing. Like I always sat through the credits anyway. So I was always here for it. I'm always, my favorite is like, wait, this was filmed in Michigan? Like, there's always that one thing at the end that surprises me from the credits. And usually,
which is great.
It's location. Sometimes I'm surprised by other things, but usually it's, wait, Michigan?
Hey. Don't be knocking Michigan.
I'm not knocking Michigan. It just doesn't like. It's just like, all right, okay. I mean, yeah, it's cold. Maybe you know, that's fair. That was the one where I was like, wait a minute, really?
Okay, I've told this story many times over the course of this entire season, but I'm gonna wait until we get that credit, and I'm gonna tell the story again.
I'm excited
so that you can actually hear the story because there is a story about Michigan.
All right,
there you go.
I like it.
You know, and I got to bring that up. You know, okay. I can't. You know, on this. I assume that in tomorrow's episode, I will not bring it up. So I might as well bring it up today, just so anyone, you know, who's been listening, who's made it through the 122 episodes so far, you know, can be reminded once again of my Michigan story. Okay. You know, so we'll get there.
Yeah.
So first of all, why don't you tell me and everyone your background with Die Hard 2?
So this is where I'm sad to say it's fuzzy. And I mean that in like the best possible way. Like I have seen Die Hard 2. I do not have any recollection when I first watched it or when I second. Like I know it and I know the beats. And yet it's now because Die Hard has become like more of a holiday staple, terrestrially on television, at least in syndication. Die Hard 2 is one of the and subsequent diehards are the ones that like I forget parts of, even though I still know all the beats. And so,
okay, were you surprised by some of the, you know, some of the surprises here then because of that, or you remembered them?
I remembered them, but what I was most surprised by was how, especially for its era, and I want to put it in context of its era, this is a sequel that probably best embraces that it's a sequel. Like,
yes.
Another basement, another elevator. Why does this always keep happening to us? There's some great lines of dialogue, but there's also nods to the camera where,
yes,
I think better than even like, and because this is an era where we still have Beverly Hills Cop 2. Like, there, it's not the only franchise that's getting a sequel in the early, late 80s, early 90s. But this is the one.
Every movie got sequels. Come on. I mean, 48 Hours got a sequel.
But I think this is the one that did it best in acknowledging the sequelness of it.
Correct.
In a positive way. Not like a nod to the camera, not a nod to, just in a, okay, all right, this is, you know, John McClane's Die Hard. I mean, yeah. This is his Groundhog Day. I mean, you know, it's just like, that's all right, right, okay, this is, all right, okay, whatever. And I loved that. The things I forgot were, even though he plays a big part, completely forgot about William Atherton. Because when I think of Die Hard 2, before I had rewatched it for this podcast, I only ever think about the snow and all of the stuff after they take the church.
Okay, first of all, do you know that all of the snow in this movie is fake?
Yes.
There is not a single amount of real snow in this movie because they got screwed every single place that they went. There was no snow, and it was the winter of 1990. Everywhere they went, they were in Denver, they were in Washington, they were in Seattle, they were in Michigan. We'll get there. Every place they went to, when they got there, they're like, "Where the hell's the snow?"
No, it makes
they shipped in snow for one of the sets, and the snow melted on the way, and they only had ice. Okay, they put down snow blankets on the ground, and then because of the winds, the snow blankets all got blown away. I mean, they just had so much trouble. I mean, if you listen to the commentary by Rennie Harlan, he talks all about it, how, you know, if you want to talk about a curse, this movie was cursed by the fact that it did not have any real snow.
Yeah, I think you can tell because real snow doesn't come across well on camera, and this snow photographs very well.
Okay, that's fair.
But going in, that's all I remember. Like, I don't like it's the you know the fire the
Did
fuel,
you remember the twist?
The fuel, the Did fire. You... Yes, I remembered the twist.
Okay. You remembered you recognized the blue and red tape?
I did. And what's funny is I recognized it at the very beginning, and there was a part of my brain that was like, that feels important. And it's not until like halfway through that I'm like, oh, it is important. But like, what's funny is I think it's a rewatch thing. Like, I don't think on first watch, that's something you pay attention to until much later. But the first round that they show has tape on it, and I'm like, that's going to be important.
Yeah. Yes. Again, I was actually able to figure that out because of another movie when I first saw this. I saw this in the theater twice within 16 hours.
Okay.
You know, I went to a special showing on July 3rd, 1990, probably like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And then I went with a different friend the following day to the first showing at noon, you know. And So when I was watching it the first time, I was reminded of a book / TV movie called The Park Is Mine with Tommy Lee Jones, where the character does the exact same thing. Okay. He has, you know, blanks. I don't know if it's exactly red and blue, but, you know, he has blanks and he has regular live bullets and he keeps switching between them and he has tape, colored tape on them in order to. So when I watched this movie and I saw the tape, I was like, that's what they're doing here. You know, I was able to figure it out real quickly from that, where I didn't need to wait until a subsequent viewing to start looking at how that all does. I mean, again, it's a fluke. It's not something, you know, I'm not trying to say that I'm more intelligent than everyone else and I was able to figure it out. It's because of a movie clue.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to. I'll say the other clue to this, even without the tape, is every time. Every time they go for their guns, they change the clip.
Right.
Almost as if like, which by the way, would not be how it normally works. Normally you still have some ammo left. So you don't have to check what, what color tape is on your rounds before you go. You're like, oh, I need my gun.
Desperate.
And so that's that's a pretty big, I think they did that on purpose, where like every time they need the gun, it literally almost feels like red, blue, so that they have to show you on camera that they're changing it and they all look at it. But I mean, the other thing which made me laugh, and I think this is a thing that looking back on these movies specifically, I understand that they had to be in close proximity to the airport in order to hack into the system, so to speak, but they would have needed one laptop instead of a room full of equipment, right? Like I just the economy of technology now, they might've still had to hardwire in, but they could have done it with a single piece of equipment instead of like all this stuff that they'll have to, you know, cause think about how easy, much easier it would have been to pick up the laptop and take it with them rather than leaving C4 behind.
Right.
To blow everything else up. It's like they go into the church and it's just empty.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the fact that it's very possible that this was, you know, their unit's specialty, that they were able to take over like small dictator countries, you know, by taking over the airport. And that's how they all knew how to, you know, work all of the equipment and things like that.
Yeah. I also think it's, and this didn't occur to me until after I finished watching it, but it's like, so far, and I say this with an asterisk, but not really, but like, so far in the Die Hard franchise, McClane is only going up against international terrorists, basically. Like, I understand there's some, you know, guys switching sides from the home front, so to speak, but like, he's not fighting, like, I don't know, internal domestic policy people.
Right. Now, I mean, you do know the, you know, what the characters represent here.
Yes.
From real life.
I do. And I, there is a part of me that, just like I want to with Die Hard, like I want to read 58 minutes. Like, cause I have, it's basically a book that is now again on my list of things to read.
Yes, I want to reread it also. I wasn't able to find a copy because all the copies that I saw were like $100. You know, it was like, you know, it's not something that's in print anymore. So it was very difficult to try and find it. So I actually never got around to rereading the novel. I used to have it, obviously, because, you know, I was a kid that I would buy novelizations of movies and novels that movies are based on, or I would take them out of the library and I would read them and I'd love them, you know, like, I mean, even Toy Soldiers. Toy Soldiers with Sean Astin and whatever. So, I mean, that was based on a book by William P. Kennedy. And I remember going to the library and taking it out and just loving the book.
So,
you know,
in a hat tip to what, viewers will hear from me in the future, Red Alert by Peter Bryant is on a shelf behind me, which is the basis for Strangelove. And it's one of those where it's like, there are plenty of people that came to it that knew of Red Alert before the movie came out. But like, sometimes you go, oh wait, this is based on a book, time to check out the original material. And that was one of them. And this is another one where I'm like, I kind of want to know. Yes. Give me Starship Troopers. Yes, I want to know more. Like,
yes,
always.
No, but the annoying thing is when you read these books, whether it's a novelization of the movie or it's a movie, it's the novel that the movie is based on, you're going to find so many discrepancies that are usually going to drive you nuts.
No, I can put it aside. And I think it's...
No, drive you nuts from the perspective that you're saying, damn, why didn't they use that in the movie?
Oh, yeah. Or, no, yeah. Yeah, I still, you got to put it aside, because there aren't that many original ideas out there, man. Like, everything is going to be like, oh, hey, you know, like, I mean, and look, anybody who's watched any show, specifically like The Simpsons, but like, I was a bigger fan of like some of the Futurama stuff, but like, when you're in sci-fi, Futurama's done a lot of spoofs too, so it's like, oh, Futurama did an episode like this. Why didn't this movie, you know, this billion budget movie do this other thing? I get it. No, you got to put it aside. I do want to say, though, before I forget, I had to. And look, my parents, my mother was in banking, and she was in banking for long enough that I think she worked at one bank, but under seven different banks. Okay, there were takeovers. So when Northeast Airlines flashes on the screen, for as much as it does, I was like, I need to know what happened to Northeast Airlines. They just merged with Delta and died, basically.
That's right, in the early 1970s.
But it also made me think of, like, that research made me come up with this one question for you, which is, why is it Northeast Air? Look, this movie takes place, in theory, when it releases in the 80s, where presumably Northeast Airlines is dead and just under the umbrella of Delta, that I guess Delta couldn't repaint all the planes yet. Like, it just, I don't know.
No. Basically, I think what happened here is that instead of saying Northwest, they just changed it to Northeast. And they didn't have Wikipedia back then. No one probably thought about the fact that there was a Northeast airline 20 years earlier. That's what I think.
Okay.
Because look at all the names. You have Fiji Air, and you have Windsor Air. And I'm trying to remember if there are any others that we actually get to see what they are. But it's supposed to be a made-up name, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, you and I have, and everyone else nowadays, we have the ability to go look things up on the internet. Back then, people didn't. You know, so let's put it this way. Even if the screenwriters figured it out, okay, 99% of the moviegoers had no clue.
Yeah, that's fair.
Really was a Northeast airline at some point. And even the ones who do know didn't care.
Yeah.
Because it didn't even fly. It didn't. Why would – see, that's I thought was your question. Why is Northeast Airlines flying from L.A. to Dulles? I thought that was what your question was going to be.
Oh, no. I figured – see, there's always those weird things where it's like, well, they must also be flying out of Dulles, which is why I was like, I'm not worried about that, because there's plenty of weird things. Like, Southwest is now a national airline in the United States, sure. Right? And despite the fact that they should only be a hub of the Southwest. I get that, but like – also,
but again, that's now. That's not in the late 80s and early 90s. You know?
That's fair. And I did want to say the other very important piece to the early part of this movie is, the older I get, the more I'm like John McClane and I hate technology. The older I get, the more John McClane.
And think about the fact of how much technology there was for John McClane in 1990 and how much technology there is for us in 2023.
I don't have to, because I watched him beat the crap out of Justin Long, who was just there with a keyboard many sequels later. Okay. So
we'll get there.
I know. I'm just saying, like, but I love the idea that it starts. He, like, that welcome to the 20th century John starts here. It really does.
Now you do know that there are a lot of flaws in the movie regarding the whole idea of the airphones.
Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah. But I never flew first class. So, and I think, like a lot of moviegoers that wouldn't question Northeast Airlines, there's probably a lot of moviegoers who had never been in the upper cabin of a 747, you know, or I don't think 727s had upper, but they had first class. And it was just like, all right, whatever goes on upstairs happens upstairs.
Well, this plane doesn't happen upstairs. It's all happening on the same level.
It feels like there's a shot or two, though, of them going of the stewardess.
No. No, not at all. Because when Holly looks back and sees Thornburg talking with Victor.
Oh, yeah.
They're on the same level.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. It's,
no, I think it was an early. For me,
this is an Airport 77.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Has, you know, different layers or Air Force One or things like that. You know, you have plenty of movies that will emulate having multiple levels. No, this plane does not have multiple levels.
But yeah, so. I even when I flew, I don't fly anymore, but even when I flew, I never was in first class. So it's like, meh.
Yeah, I've never flown in first class either. But again, it's a discrepancy here because we're not sure if she's completely in first class or if she's in business class.
That was the part of the movie I forgot because I was expecting that when she's like, yeah, it, you know, the whole restraining order thing. I was like, oh, they're just going to move her to first class. Like in my, there are parts of the brain where you're like, there are expectations that you have, even if you've seen it before and can't remember. I was like, that's they're
right.
Just
you go to the first row and we'll put you in the back row. And that's it. You know?
Yeah. Although,
and close the curtain.
I do believe that we have to agree now. This is two movies you've done where can we just say William Atherton was the best of the 1980s and early 90s?
Oh, that we know. There's no question about it. I mean, Paul Gleason gives him a good run for his money.
Yeah, but I mean, but outside of just this, I'm just saying, like, he's so good as the guy you love to hate. Ghostbusters, yeah. Real Genius, the other Die Hard. Like, yeah. Just, and then I gotta tell you, love the idea. And it's at the end of the credits. So I just want to say that now. So I don't know if it's part of our minute. This photo play is not sponsored by, which is a thing.
No, it's not. That's tomorrow. We'll talk about that.
I just want to say this is something that will never all that like that. That's a part of Hollywood that is no longer existing. That's a line of text you will never ever see anymore in a Hollywood movie.
Wait a second, I don't even see the line here. Where's there a line that it?
There was at the very end of the film. It's like it came up on my DVD at least, where it's like this photo play is not sponsored by, and then there's like a paragraph of text.
No, we don't. I don't have that on the version that I have. So if you want to bring it up and read it, that would be fine too.
I can't. I don't have a disc on this drive. Discs are hard, man. But I'm just saying, it was a line that caught my eye because I was like, everything's now sponsored. Like, if we make this movie now, even though it is about airline terrorists, there's going to be a bidding war to make sure it happens on Delta or American Airlines. Because we want our brand in front of moviegoers. Rob, I want people to know my plane is the plane.
Yeah, if you're gonna hijack a plane, hijack my plane.
Yes, exactly. Because my plane's worth hijacking. Just
yeah, I don't know if there are that many airlines that want to advertise that way.
No, probably not.
Probably not. You know, which is why, like, for instance, you know, I always love the fact that in Castaway, you know, they didn't get permission from FedEx to use FedEx there. They just decided we're using FedEx.
See, it feels like
– and FedEx was so happy because they got so much –
that's the thing.
Credit.
I don't understand why you don't put a bidding war out because it could have easily been UPS. And then they would – like, I just – I see that world that way. Like, why not? It's going to be one of these two companies. Somebody's going to give us neither of them are going to care, but somebody's going to give us at least $50 and that'll go somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I think in Castaway, the fact that the plane crashes, there are reasons that you don't necessarily want it to be your brand.
Look, the stuff gets delivered at the end of the movie. I mean, we will get it to you, no matter what.
Yeah, but not because of FedEx. It's because of Chuck Nolan. So come on.
Yeah, but we employ him, so technically,
not anymore. We've now paid him, paid him off. You know, he now is retired and can do whatever he wants, and he's going to get a monthly salary. You know, for all the hardships that he's had over the last 5 years. You know, because our plane went down in the middle of the Pacific when there's no reason why you should have been flying across the Pacific. But whatever, that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
We're not doing Castaway right now. And it's a movie that I love, but I don't think I will ever do it minute by minute because I don't think that it is, there's enough to talk about in every single minute there. And I'm not a nautical person, so you know, like I have friends that would be able to talk about Jim O'Kane. I know you're listening. Jim could talk about, you know, the exact point of where the island is, and you know, talk about like why did the plane veer off and all that stuff. But no, not me.
No, I can't. I might remember some of my sailing from like Boy Scouts, but right now, Crosby, Stills, and Nash's Southern Cross is as close as I get to nautical. And that's a song.
There you go.
Okay, so.
All right, that's fair. Completely fair. All right, so let's talk about the minute.
Yeah.
So it starts off where we continue with the list of the engineers, and we have a list of 15 engineers, which it's really funny because you normally don't have this in movies where they will just give you a group of names of people who are cast members.
You normally would
give them all names. You would say, okay, this is, you know, even if it's their own names, you would say, okay, this is Jerry, this is Marty, this is Bob, this is Dick, you know, that type of thing. You don't usually group them together like
this. I was so shocked by these credits, like the bad guys, like just yes. the group, because it literally threw me for a loop. Because you're right, there is the. You know, maybe there's title cards or what have you that we now put at the back of the movies, like with Marvel and stuff. And then eventually there's the scroll, and the scroll is just in cast order or in order of pay or appearance or what have you. And here we're literally sectioning them off, and it's not, it's something we expect for, like, here's the audio engineers. Here's the digital graphics guys, you know. But to separate each of the cast groups, I paused it. It took me a moment because I was like, wait, this is what we're doing?
That's right. And the thing that throws me off about it is that most of these engineers have lines in the movie. You know, and you can't tell who says what. There's no way of knowing.
No.
You know, the guy who makes the Batman comment, and the guy, you know, the guy who makes the comment, let's go, you know, hey, just run down to Radio Shack. You know, I'd love to know who they are. You can't figure it out because, you know, they don't have names. It's just engineer number one, engineer number two, engineer number 12.
Which is usually, you know, what you get. Like, I think of a movie like Apollo 13, where anybody who's not a speaking part becomes engineer number one, two, three, and four. But everybody with a line... Right. Has a name. Mm-hmm. Maybe now is not the time to bring this up, but like, I will say, I did think this movie was a tad too long. Like, I don't.
Well, you made it through to the end, so that's fine.
I will watch long movies. It's just this one, for some reason, felt a little long.
Because you need to have a movie 90 minutes. For you, 90 minutes is your cutoff. I know that.
I will watch longer movies, but they have to have a reason.
Of course you will, because I make you.
No, not just you. There are other people. But, like, there has to be a reason. I think there were just moments in this movie where I was like, I get, okay, move along. It's a long movie.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. But it's still fun.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It is. And look, I'm sure all of those engineers are very happy they got any credit at all.
Yeah. That's right. And they all can basically say, oh, I was the guy who made the Radio Shack comment. You know? Nobody will know if they didn't.
I did have a speaking part.
That's right. Which is why I love, like, the Naked Gun. Okay, the Naked Gun, if you're familiar with the credits, yeah. Okay, they have an area of the credits where they just list the quotes.
Yeah.
You know, like, you have a character that goes, hey, it's Enrico Palazzo, you know, and that's how they differentiate who this actor is.
Well, it's a heck of a lot easier than trying to come up with a name for that character.
Oh, for sure. But obviously it's done in jest, yeah. And it's just hilarious to be able to do something like that, because you wouldn't think of doing that. Most producers or most screenwriters are going to say, okay, let's just call this guy, guy in stands, yeah, or something like that, you know, not, hey, it's Enrico Palazzo, you know, and throughout the, they have like 20 of them.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious, you know, and it would have made much more sense for them to do it this way. You know, to have the guy saying, you're too low, guys. Pull up. Oh, that was Jim Hudson. Okay. Now we know which guy said it.
I will say, though, having them differentiate each of the planes, if that's the reason that they differentiated everything else, I guess it makes sense. Because then you don't have to worry about pilot such and such. You can just do the Windsor team, pilot, Cole Meany, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Cole Meany. How can you make that Star Trek? I know you're an original series guy, and you haven't moved.
I have.
On yet.
No, I'm in season six of Next Gen.
Oh, so okay, so you know O'Brien.
I know O'Brien, but and this is what happens when you come at Star Trek at a later date. I was like, oh, it's the guy from Con Air.
That's right. And that's the way it works.
Yeah.
You know, you do that. I do that in movies all the time. You see somebody, you're like, oh, I know where that guy's from.
Yeah.
It's you know, and there's usually some place that you remember someone from. Now, for me, it was the opposite. You know, like I saw Cole Meany here, and when I saw him in Con Air, I'm like, oh, hey, that was the pilot of Windsor Air in Die Hard 2. You know, it just works. It works the other way around also.
Yep. It all depends on what order you watch it.
That's right. And then basically after the engineers, we get a few extra people here. You know, we've mentioned a lot of them over the course of the whole show. Some of them, like, you have two airport cops, no idea who they are. But did you notice who the tow truck driver is? I mean, I mentioned this the first week, but did you notice who plays the tow truck driver? No. David Willis Sr.
Ah.
Bruce Willis is dead.
Nice. No, I missed that. I mean, I usually read the names. I missed that one. There's a lot of surprising names in very small roles in the early part of this credits that I think I may have been like star powered out by the time we got down here.
That's fair.
Like Patrick Stewart.
That's fair.
Not Patrick Stewart.
You're back with the Next Generation.
what's his face? Terminator.
William Sandler?
No, Terminator.
Oh, Robert Patrick.
I was like, I did notice him in the movie for the 30 seconds he's on screen.
That's right.
And then it's like, oh, okay. Yep. There's that guy. Anyway.
Yeah. Right. And then they finish the cast credits and we get stunts. And I mean, this is always grouped together in movies, but did you count how many stuntmen there are?
No, but I will say this. It seemed like not enough. Given the...
They have 51 stuntmen.
Yeah, but for a movie like this, especially... I just always assume when there's crowd work and like there were panicked crowds that there are going to be extra stunt people whose job it is to fall while the crowd's happening, that kind of thing. So when I looked and that... You can kind of gauge how many there is. I didn't count them, but 51, it seemed like not enough for, given all the gunfire, I understand that one person can be a stunt guy for multiple stunts, but it just felt like not enough for the size and scope of this film.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Now, the funny thing is I went onto IMDb, and on IMDb, they actually have 52 stuntmen listed. There's an uncredited stuntman. So basically you had a guy, okay, whose name is Monty Jordan, okay, who either he himself or someone who knows him decided that, all right, he deserves to be listed here. And we are going to add him to IMDb as one of the stuntmen. So you have like the list, you have the section in IMDb of all the stuntmen. And, you know, you go through the list and it's all in alphabetical order. And then you get to the end and you see stunt double uncredited. Monty Jordan. Who he's the stunt double for, I couldn't tell you. He has a pretty interesting stunt career. I mean, he was in 60 different movies, including Blue Thunder, Cannonball Run, Hot Shots, Part Deux.
That's
Yeah.
Well,
apparently, you know, he somehow got into he was in Terminator 2. He was also uncredited in Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Maybe he's Robert Patrick's stuntman.
Or maybe he's just got an amazing agent who's like, you know what? These films might be out, but I know this guy was in them. So it's time to tackle the internet.
And hey, he's the stunt double for Jesse Ventura in Predator. And it says uncredited again. He's a guy who keeps getting uncredited.
Man. Well, at least he's getting his credit now.
Yes, right. And he was in The Terminator also, uncredited. This is a guy who apparently just went through IMDb and put in all the movies that he didn't get credit for. Because he was in Return of the Jedi as a stunt double, uncredited.
Man.
Yeah, this is... he was a stuntman in Alien, also uncredited.
This guy might have Capricorn this guy one. Is either full of a lot of really good stories, or he's been on set and on camera for one scene in each of these films.
Yeah, because although his first uncredit in in IMDb is for True Grit in 1969.
My first uncredit.
That's great.
Yeah.
That is really great. All right, so we continue, and then we get a list of all the pilots. So we have 8 pilots here. I'm assuming that these are the people who are either flying the flying the cameras, or because you know this is before they had drones. They actually had to put someone in a plane or
helicopter. I would assume it's a helicopter so you could get some better shots. Right. But there is a thing, and when we get to the airplane airport movies, I'm sure we'll talk about it. But like, while I don't like to fly, I don't fly now, and I really didn't love flying before. There is something about a plane being shot well that is still beautiful regardless. And it's one of the things where, like, this movie only kind of does that because circumstances of it being night and snowy kind of take away from a lot of the beautiful, like, aerial shots we would normally have.
Right, okay.
But they still exist. I mean, I think that's the other thing. If this movie takes place in the daytime, I think you get a lot more external shots while we're talking within the pilots and co-pilots are talking to each other, which are now just internal cockpit shots because it's dark. How many times are we going to just show illuminated windows in a dark sky? Like, it's just at a certain point. Okay.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, especially since most of it is on a soundstage.
Yeah, yeah. Also, can you imagine being like, all right, Rob, we're shooting this movie during a snowstorm at night. Go get some external plane shots in the sky. Like, oh, sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds easy. No.
That's right.
Although, in fairness, I'm very surprised they didn't call out the helicopter pilot from the news.
What do you mean? He's got.
Oh, does he get a separate one? I don't remember.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Because in the section of the news
talks,
crew, because
he talks, but that guy also has to be a stunt pilot, or maybe.
No, probably I guess not, they probably used it. Not happening.
Yeah.
it's probably not happening.
I'm trying to think of the there. I mean, now I'm trying to go back in the way they cut that scene. So yeah, that probably isn't the same guy who's flying it, but yeah.
Right. I mean, his name is Robert Lipton. He's the chopper pilot.
I get all of my helicopter stunt information from Airwolf.
Okay.
That's where I learned all of my stuff from those two.
Yeah, I mean, I used to love watching Airwolf, except for the fact that Airwolf, you know, you'd have a helicopter shooting at them and they keep missing and they don't get anything. And then Airwolf just shoots one torpedo missile at them and that's
yep.
it.
You know? Yep. I actually loved the B plot of like them being a stunt team. Because that was some, yes. there was some fun, it was just some fun helicopter stuff.
That's right. Just,
they would be the ones brought in for this shot. For that shot.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But the Robert Lipton is not a stuntman at all. Okay. He has 62 acting credits, and he has a special thanks from the movie Dahmer. Special thanks to all those who helped make this film possible. So I don't know if that means he contributed to the funding of the film, or, you know, maybe he reminded them of Jeffrey Dahmer or something. I don't know. Yeah. No clue. But yeah, and you know, he's got a great line in the movie where he basically says, "I may be crazy, I'm not that crazy."
Yeah, yeah, that's.
Yeah. Then we get the music credit, and surprisingly, there is only four music credits here.
I mean, there's only one that matters.
It doesn't even give us.
There's
it doesn't even give us any of the music by by Michael Kamen here.
Yeah, but he got a credit earlier in the credits.
That's right, but you don't see the music, his original music. Usually, you know, you have maybe it would say Die Hard 2 theme or something like that.
Yeah, they didn't do songs because there are other songs in the movie too.
Yes. Yes. Well, don't you remember what happened with Die Hard? There were songs in the credits that weren't even in the movie.
Yeah. Well, that's. But
because they were used for inspiration.
But anytime I see Michael Kamen, I'm just more amazed at how he's not mentioned with, you know, Williams and some of the other bigger names like Shore. Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, look, I get it. Not everybody can be everything, but like Kamen may not be as quote unquote well known, but like his credits are ridiculous.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, if you were just to look at the amount of, I think he has like maybe 200 credits on IMDb, if not more. I'm trying to remember what the actual number is.
That like Metallica went to him for like when they did the S&M stuff. Like, of course. Makes sense.
Here he has 85 music department credits, 97 composer credits, 126 soundtrack credits.
Yeah. Legend.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one who left us too soon.
Yeah.
You know, but so there's only four music credits. We have, old Cape Cod, which is the only thing that has the full credit really.
Yep.
And you know, that is, also, you know, the intro and outro of these episodes. And then we have two musical songs from way back when that are being used here, Finlandia and Carol of the Bells. And then you have Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, which is how the credits opened up here.
Yeah.
Now, the next credit just blew me away. Bonnie Bedelia's Bags, provided by Prada Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Okay. What bags does Bonnie Bedelia have in this movie? We don't see her at the conveyor belt waiting for her luggage to show up.
I read it as like catering provided by Subway. Like, you know, like they gave her those, like that. Those are just her personal bags.
Yes, but we don't see them. The only bag we see is she takes her, you know, archaic laptop and puts it in a laptop case.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, the lady next to her has a bag, you know, where she takes out the zapper from.
Yeah,
but
no, I'm just, yeah, I mean, this goes back to the knives.
Hey, we'll get there. We'll get there. Then we have the Carol Lombard Kids Children's Choir, who are singing in one of the very first scenes in the movie. We get them for like 5 seconds singing as John like walks by them, and that's it.
Yeah, while he's doing that thing where you just randomly walk through a terminal while smoking. Yeah, that's a completely normal thing.
Well, that's what you did in 1990. That's exactly what you did John in McClane. 1990. You know, he's been on Nightline, and you know, they did an article on him in Newsweek and Time. So, you know, why not? And then we get the credit that you just mentioned. Knives designed and created by Jack W. Crane, Weatherford, Texas. Now, anyone who remembers the conversation Jason and I had two seasons ago, at this very episode, you know, the penultimate episode, we had this credit in the original Die Hard, and there were no knives.
This time, we have a knife in the movie.
How many knives can you remember seeing here?
It's just two, right? The one that gets pulled on McClane and the one that the general slices the one dude's throat with. It's just two, right?
No. Okay. There's more than two.
Oh, no. That's all I got. What's the...
Okay, so you have the one with, I believe...
It's one of the...
I believe his name is Khan.
Yeah.
So Khan pulls out a knife when he's fighting John before he gets the icicle in his eye.
Yep.
Okay. Stuart pulls out a knife when he's fighting John on the wing of the airport.
Oh, okay.
The wing of the airplane.
Okay.
And Grant uses the knife to cut... Talford's neck.
All right.
Those are the three that automatically pop up when I think about it. It is possible that there might have been another one or two that were shown at some point through the rest of the movie. But those are the three ones. So, you know, Jack Crane actually had a reason to be credited here, unlike in the original Die Hard.
Well, I mean, look, here's the other thing. If they were sheathed knives, that doesn't help us. Because that's just a handle.
That's correct. That is very true. And then we get a bunch of special thanks, which I couldn't get that much information about them because they don't really mention anything about this stuff in IMDb, so I couldn't really go into it more. But they basically have here a total of seven credits. So we have the first one. It says Larry Waterman Proton TV. Absolutely no clue. I couldn't figure out who or what Larry Waterman is or what Proton TV is. I don't know if you looked it up. Did you
look it up? I didn't look it up, but the only thing I could think about while that happened was there were a few times, especially for a movie of this era, where there were some television screens that looked good on camera. And it's possible that this guy's one thing was turning down the frequency of a CRT so it wouldn't refresh at a rate that would always have the green line for its era. That's the only thing I could think of because when you're dealing with so many screens, you kind of expect the flicker. And it's the kind of thing you notice nowadays because we don't see that really ever.
Correct.
And it didn't really appear a lot in any of the screens. We don't see that line reflowing. So all I could think is this is a guy who Hollywood calls when they're like, all right, I don't want the green line. All right. I don't want the white line. I don't want the line. Like, can we get rid of the filter? That's all I could think of. That's my guess. Fair enough. The internet can tell me I'm wrong.
Well, the internet doesn't have information about it, so I couldn't tell you. But the thing I found really interesting is that the name Waterman, there is an actress in the movie named whose name is Waterman. So I was like, okay, maybe there's some connection here. I couldn't find if there actually was, but I just found it really funny that the stewardess on the Windsor plane, one of the stewardesses, her name is Felicity Waterman. So I was like, okay, maybe Larry Waterman is her husband, you know, and they's like, okay, hey, Felicity, ask your husband if he can bring one of those Proton TVs down here, you know, to help us out. That's where my thinking goes.
Okay.
Then you have a company named Modern Props, which I guess it's self-explanatory.
Yep.
You know, it's a company that is giving them modern props for the movie. Okay. Cerruti 1881 Paris. It looks to me that this is also something with luggage.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Then you have the California Film Commission with no names listed in there. And then the Michigan Film Office, but Daryl Beasley is the one who gets credited. So you see in Michigan, they had help from a guy named Daryl Beasley. Then you have Black & Decker. What Black & Decker appliance do you think they used in this movie? You have any clue?
So the only thing I can think of is that very first ambush, they are moving tools. They have tools on top of their weapon. That's,
well, they're painting.
They're painting, but there's also tools. There's also stuff around. It's because it's still under construction. It's not just paint supplies. There were other things. Okay. So I'm thinking that they must have supplied some tools, a hammer. Here's a screwdriver, yeah. You know.
They're like, hello, is this Black & Decker? We're making a movie. We need a few screwdrivers and some nails. Can you send them over?
Yeah.
And then the final special credit here is the citizens of Alpena, Michigan. Yay.
I don't know where Alpena is.
Alpena is in the northern part of Michigan.
Okay. Now, when I worked in tourism for a little bit, there's a lot of crossover between tourism of any kind and the film bureau. And I did a little bit of work with my local film bureau. My assumption, having no actual knowledge of this, is that it was an inconvenience of some kind. Like, this is one of those things, like, we thank this city, we thank that city, but this city, we stopped traffic on Main Street for 2 hours, so we're going to thank the citizens of, right? Just something as small as that. So it doesn't, it could also be that those citizens were in the, or on film, but I think it's also like there might have been some kind of like, our lights are going to keep these people up. Let's thank them.
Right.
You know, one of the
That's
two.
That's right. Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. And that's pretty much it. That we finished this minute.
Yeah. I will say this. I like this movie. I think this movie gets, I don't think this movie gets talked about enough when compared to all the other diehards, I guess. But I think I'd still rather watch the first one.
Okay, that's fair.
You know. Yeah.
You know, that's fair. But you can spread the wealth. You can, you know, watch the first one, watch the second one, watch the third one, and then forget about the fact that there are two more. That's it. You know, you have the trilogy.
I didn't mind Live Free or Die Hard. We'll get to that later.
I didn't mind it either.
But
I didn't mind it either.
And I still haven't watched the most recent one.
You've never seen it?
No. Should I save it for when you invite me on for that one?
I assume that I will not be doing that one minute by minute. I might have like a special episode, you know, just making fun of it as it,
all right.
You
well,
know,
I'll watch
maybe
it.
Maybe doing a running commentary.
If you invite me on, I'll watch that one. Oh, I'll save it for that. Yeah.
Okay. But again, for me, it's a trilogy, one pretty good movie, and then one terrible movie. That's the way I look at it. Because as much as I enjoy Live Free or Die Hard, it's not at the same level as the original trilogy.
It's very much a different. I don't like saying this, but like it's a different time. It's almost a different
That's
movie.
Right.
It like the names are the same, but it might as well be a completely different franchise.
Correct. Yeah. That's my point. Yep. But the first three, that's the way they are.
Yeah.
All right, great. So now let's get into the various segments that we normally do over the week. I mean, today is a Saturday, so people have come to, you know, to listen to the penultimate episode, and tomorrow you'll all be around for the final episode. You know, we have these two weekend shows to finish off this season. But even so, since you haven't been on the rest of the season, so we'll still go through the five segments.
Yep.
So the first one we got is McLean Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So, and Jason, start with your number five and work your way up.
I have a tie at five.
No ties allowed. You always try to
fine,
cheat.
Fine. This is what I'll do.
You are a cheater.
All right. My runner up in number six would be Pulp Fiction. It was a hard to move that any further up because it's such an ensemble movie. It's not like he steals a scene. He doesn't steal the movie. I don't think. Anyway, number five.
Okay, but we are dealing with his best performances, yep. So it could be that, you know, even though he's not in the entire movie, he could still be.
I one of the five I've got ahead of it are better performances.
Okay,
Armageddon number five. Easily.
Okay.
Because I think it's his best. I like him as the father figure in this film. I know there are parts of it that are a little bit hokey. It's the late 90s. It's an action flick. It's a disaster flick. But dad Bruce Willis to daughter Liv Tyler loved the performance.
Yes.
Number four, Red. Because there is a part of me, as we get further up my list, I like a Bruce Willis action comedy. And Red might be my favorite Bruce Willis action comedy.
Okay. That's fair.
Number three, The Whole Nine Yards. It feels like the movie he had the most fun on. I don't know if that's true, but like it looks like he had a lot of fun playing a retired contract killer. And I think it might be one of his best non-McClane type roles. Number two, The Last Boy Scout. Because for my money, Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans are a match made in heaven. That's the buddy cop movie that would have made Cop Out better, I think.
Okay. That's
just my opinion. And number one, my favorite movie that Bruce Willis is in, and one of my favorite movies of all time, The Fifth Element.
You don't have a Die Hard on there?
Wow. I chose not to put a Die Hard on here, but it would have been in that four or five range because I like it, but I didn't want. I don't think it's up. I don't think it's up there.
Okay.
He's playing a character, and I think part of it is a lot of these movies. Now, The Whole Nine Yards got a sequel, and Red got a sequel. But these are all one-off performances. I think that when we talk about that kind of stuff, it's better not to be in a franchise because there's a little – not. It's not even recency bias. It's just like you've seen it, and now it's like, all right, well – pick one of his best Die Hard performances. And it's like, no, okay, I won't. I'll just either choose the Die Hard franchise or I won't. So I went without. But it would make my top 10, but it's not on the list.
Okay, that is definitely fair. Yeah. Okay, so the Tuesday segment is known as Disaster Tuesday. This was actually a disaster. It was a disaster segment. It didn't work. It didn't flow within the show, and anyone listening to any of the Tuesday episodes will probably agree with me. And the whole idea was that I decided to pick famous people that that died in plane crashes and talk a little bit about them. You know, it's sort of a little bit of a downer.
Yeah.
Even though some of them were really, really fascinating stories, you know, but it's the way it is. So that what I was going to talk about with you is, since I know that you're a sports fan and that you're from Pennsylvania, so let's see if you can even guess who I wanted to talk about with you.
Roy Halladay?
No.
Okay.
Go back further.
I don't. I'm not an NFL guy. So if it's NFL, I'm.
No, I'm a baseball guy. It's baseball. What famous baseball player from Pennsylvania died in 1972? I'll even give you that.
Clemente died.
That's right. Okay. It was Roberto Clemente.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, on the off season, between, you know, 1972 and 1973 seasons, he decided that he was going to, he would always do a lot of charity work.
Yep. That's why they got an award named after him.
That's right. And there was a massive earthquake in Nicaragua, and he decided that he would, you know, go there on New Year's Eve. And the plane that he chartered had mechanical problems, and it was missing a co-pilot and a flight engineer, and the plane was overloaded by 4,200 pounds and ended up crashing into the ocean on December 31st, right off the coast of Puerto Rico, due to engine failure. And unfortunately, you know, he didn't make it.
Yeah, I think recency bias, man. I immediately think of Roy Halladay.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
In my family, we have a love-hate relationship with Roberto Clemente because
you're from Philadelphia.
I'm not from Philadelphia. Okay.
I know, but that's the closest. You're closer to Philadelphia than
that's Pittsburgh. Not why I don't like him. I don't like him because his Pirates beat the Orioles twice in the series.
Okay, there you go.
But no, I appreciate the man. And obviously the Roberto Clemente Award is important. And every team, there's always 30 nominees because there's always at least one guy, if not more, on each MLB team doing good charitable works. And that gets them nominated for the award. And then they all have a nice little award show thing where each of them get to showcase what they've done for the year in terms of charitable works and givings, and then somebody wins the Roberto Clemente Award. But usually it's just, this is all the good that's been done from these nominees. So
that's right. So he won 12 Golden Gloves over his short career, which is he's tied with the record with Willie Mays for the most number of Gold Gloves for a player. He was an all-star for 13 seasons, but he was selected for 15 all-star games, meaning he had two that he, you know, was, I guess, an alternate for. He won the NL MVP in 1966, was the NL Player of the Month three times. He led the Pirates to the World Series and was twice. And he also was the World Series MVP in 1971.
And I will tell you, as a nice little hat tip, to a book I just read, he almost got drafted by the Brooklyn Dodgers. Ooh. But due to ownership change, the owner went, the GM went to Pittsburgh and decided to take him to Pittsburgh. But he could have been one of the last rookies of the Brooklyn Dodgers before they moved to LA.
That's right. Oh, well. He also was the first time that the Baseball Writers Association of America decided to change their rules for the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And they voted to waive the 5-year waiting period because of the circumstance of his death. And he was able to get 92.7% of the vote.
Yeah, it seems the least they could have done. Usually the 5-year waiting period is because some of these guys like to come out of retirement.
Yes. I just recently rewatched Mr. 3000. You know, really fun movie. Fun, stupid at the same time. But, you know, as a baseball fan, it's just fun watching Bernie Mac, you know, try to get back into shape. Right. Okay, so that's the Tuesday segment. Wednesday segment was Off the Beaten Track Aviation Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdotes, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that is somehow related to aviation or airports, whatever it is. So you got a little bit of a story for us, even though I know you don't fly.
I do.
Maybe you went to go pick someone up at the airport.
I really wish I could remember the specific details. So I didn't prepare for this only because I have a few stories, as I wasn't sure which one would pop into my head. But basically, this is the story. I, as listeners of my show know, I spent a semester abroad in Jerusalem.
Yes. Yay.
And I did this the second half of my junior year of high school. And I want to say it was Tower Air, but I don't think it was.
Makes sense. It makes
we
sense.
We flew over on Tower Air or some airline that went defunct during the semester we were there.
Oh, wow.
And so we had to get, we flew back on LL, of course, but like,
of course.
It was one of those things when it was time to get back. I know the program director was like, we don't have return tickets for you people yet. We're still working on it. And so, yeah, I flew out of Newark. I flew back into JFK, or maybe that was reversed. I don't remember. But yeah, I get to say that I flew over on one airline, and 4 months later, that airline was no more. And I had to fly back on another.
Okay, that's fair. That is a nice story, especially since I'm familiar with both of those airlines.
Yeah.
So, yes.
And I still have, they're in my office. I still have my LL headphones.
Ooh.
Shh. Yeah.
Don't tell anyone.
It's been 20 years. I don't think they can come after me anymore. I know. I think I also have a spoon because at that time they were still using metal silverware.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. It's branded. It was good stuff. Better than the That's plastic. Right.
I know people who have complete sets in their house.
Wow.
From LL or from other airlines. Yes.
Yeah. That's
I remember my stepfather, after Pan Am went out of business, he went and bought up a whole bunch of, he bought two sets of like, I think 12 piece, you know, silverware, you know, brand new. From Pan Am, and in our house we had a set of Pan Am. You know, that was the silverware we used.
I gotta say, Pan Am might be like the one brand that has survived despite not surviving. Just okay, because it's fair. Such a prominent movie airline for as long as airplanes have been in movies up until Pan Am goes under, that like, right. And it's in all of them. It's just in all of them. And so I think it will endure regardless.
Okay. That is fair.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Now let us move along to the Thursday segment, which is Aviation Thursday, where my guests will give their top five movies that are somehow related to aviation.
I'm cheating again.
No,
I'm cheating again.
Stop cheating.
One of the reasons.
Stop cheating. I'll make you come back for more than one.
That's
episode
fine.
Next
That's
time.
Fine. One of the reasons I'm cheating is because, I want to give a special shout out to Up in the Air, which is my runner up, but I just love the idea that it's kind of more terminals and more like,
but it fits in there.
It's more travel, but I don't know, for some reason it's one of the few movies that seems to, even though it's like first class, it seems to actually capture air travel in a way that none of my other movies are about to.
That's right. Okay.
Number five, Dr. Strangelove. I would want to put it
I'm
higher
surprised that's still low.
I would want to put it higher on the list, however half of the movie is not anywhere remotely near the plane. So
it doesn't matter.
I know, but we have to come up with an order. So.
Right. Okay.
Number four, Top Gun. I don't know if you can argue with that. I mean, you could probably, there are people that probably want to put it higher, but you know, there it is. Number three, The Right Stuff, which it's such a, like, I think that might be some of the best airplane photography out there. That's just me. Number two, Con Air. It's the only kind of one on my list that almost takes place.
It's that movie that Colm Meaney was in.
Yeah, it's that movie that Colm Meaney. But it's one of the few that actually takes place on, like, it features the plane. outside of my first one, outside of my number one, most of these are a lot of on the ground stuff and then some airplane stuff.
Right. Okay. That's fair though. That could be, I mean, and a big shout out to Jay and Mark of the Con Air Minute or Con Air Pod, you know, where they don't do minute by minute. They do it, scene by scene. Okay. So
yeah.
You can go and check that out, or chapter by chapter, actually.
Gotcha. And then my number one, and probably my favorite airplane movie of all time, Memphis Belle.
Ooh, I just rewatched that this
and month. It might actually be one of my favorite World War II movies, because it's one of the few movies where the actors are not playing down in age. They're all babies, right? Because they are all babies. And if you haven't seen it, you need to. It's just such a great, not because it's based on a true story, though it is. It's just it's an amazing cast. And I think they did very well. For what was it, 1990?
1990.
Okay.
90. Yes.
And then
same year as this one.
And just the fact that, like, they were able to shoot that in, I favorite, love it, it's great. Like, even the small moments of humor, like I'm hit but it's tomato soup, you know,
that's right.
I absolutely
agree. That's a great
scene. Yeah, I loved you're not a doctor. I'm not gonna go there, but yeah, Memphis Belle, I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's an under the radar movie. And I'm not trying to pun that up. I just think it really is. I don't think there's enough people that know about it. But everybody should.
Right. Okay.
Yeah,
that's fair. Great. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. And now we will move to Friday segment to finish it off. So Friday segment is something that I decided to do this season. And I actually think it works very well, where the segment is, where are they up to this weekend? Okay. So what I've done is, if it was someone who has their own, movies by minute, podcast, so I talked to them about their particular movie. If not, so I asked for, the guests' top movies. Yep. So that I could, test their memories on things, Lord, to find out where their movies are up to at this point. So we're right now at the 2 hour and 3 minutes mark. Okay.
Yep.
So, we're going to go through some of your favorite movies and find out if you can remember where those movies are up to at the 2 hour and 3 mark. Okay. So let's start with Real Genius. Okay, Real Genius. What's happening in
it's
Real Genius
over.
At the 2 hour?
It's been over.
That's right. That's right. It ended 15 minutes ago. Very good.
Oh.
You see, that's what happens when you're at the end of a movie,
I think,
that's the way these things are.
I think that one's,
so, okay.
I feel like that one's only 87 minutes. I don't even think that one hits 90.
It does. It's an hour and 48 minutes.
Okay. All right.
So it's only 15 minutes that you miss on that one. Okay. Let's go to the next one. Diner. Okay. What is going on in Diner at the 2 hour and 3 minute mark?
I think this one's over too.
Yes, it is.
Oh man. Okay. I'm kind of worried about some of the other ones I put on my list now.
And now we will go to the final one. What is going on in The Fifth Element at the 2 hour and 3 mark?
I feel like the credits are rolling. It's over. I know it's over 2 hours. So 2 hour and 3, right? 2 hour and 3?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, no, I take that back. The credits aren't rolling yet. I believe Ruby Rod is asking Corbin Dallas for a light. That's going to be my guess. I'm going to go.
No, you should have gone with your gut.
Is it credits, really? I know it's a longer movie, but it also has longer credits. So
yes, it is in the middle of the credits at that point.
Okay.
We get the credits for the art department and things like that.
All right.
at this point.
I outthought
and,
myself.
I mean, I actually watched this minute of credits there just to see if there's anything that jumped out. And in the middle, they just have something that says special thanks to Leslie Dilley. So I was like, okay, who is Leslie Dilley? Why would that name be there? You know, like, where did that come from? And it turns out that Les Dilley is an art director who worked on the Star Wars movies and worked on Raiders of the Lost Ark and things like that. He doesn't work on The Fifth Element. So apparently, you know, it must be people that he worked with.
Or it's one of those like, decided, hey, thanks for letting us walk into the studio and
right.
see
but,
some
I
stuff.
Mean, for me, it was just really strange because it's like right in the middle.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Also interesting, you didn't pick the longest movie to really trip me up, because I, of course I gave him more than three.
Of course you did, but I don't think there was any other ones that you gave me that actually were this long.
I thought The Man Who Would Be King would be at least 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, that one is, but I'm not a fan of that one, so I didn't want to go rewatch that and find you know, find a copy of okay. it to figure out where that was. So yeah, okay. That's you're right about
fair.
That one.
That's fair. No, all right. Yeah, I like shorter movies.
Yes, well, that we know.
Okay. I like shorter. Although my airplane movies, The Right Stuff is almost 3 hours. So.
That's right. That wasn't on your list.
I like it though. I think I like that segment. Despite the fact that now at least I'm not going to come prepared next time either, but at least, you know, I got to be worried when you're like, well, give me a list. Also, I panic when people ask me for a list. So,
well, you know, never panic, never panic. Okay. So is there anything else you want to say about this movie?
I do believe by whatever classification you would classify Die Hard as a Christmas movie, would also make this a Christmas movie.
Okay,
and,
of course.
And so yes. By that token, I feel like it should be talked about more. That's okay. All. That's spread fair. The love.
But the problem is it's always in the shadow of its older brother.
Oh,
that's
sure.
What it comes down to.
Absolutely. But
you know, as much as I love it.
But I feel like, you know, there's, I don't know, there's a place for both, right?
Or there should be. Of course.
Yeah.
And there is. There definitely is. All right, great. So do you want to let everyone know where they can find you?
Yes, I'm on the internet, agentpalmer.com. That's usually where I put all my blogs, though I have been starting to write elsewhere if I can. Hit me up. You can find me at Agent Palmer on all of the platforms. So if you're on a platform, I'm sure I'm there. And then the podcast, The Palmer Files, is a long-form conversation podcast that you can find wherever you're listening to this show right now.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So I will be back tomorrow for the final episode of this season. Jason, thank you very much for joining me once again.
Absolutely.
All right. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here.